Did you hear about the C++ class that got the fashion makeover? Yeah, true story. Architect gave him a bunch of pointers. Hey, howdy ho, Daniel Markham here with Weekly Nerd Roundup. We've got a couple people right now. I think we've got a third one coming. Greg Young is here for the first time. Greg said my jokes had to be funny. Obviously, it is the first time for Greg. Very sorry that is the case. If you haven't been to a Nerd Roundup before, you haven't missed a damn thing, really. I think Greg described it as a bunch of folks getting together during a conference and just sort of kicking around the breeze and talking about tech stuff, and that's what it is. We try to model the behavior you want to see in teams, and good teams are relaxed and able to talk about anything. And so the only rules we have are there are no rules. I'll bring a list of articles that I'll bring up we can talk about or not. As long as we're having fun, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. Greg Young and James Grinning. Hey guys.
Hello.
Howdy.
Welcome.
I apologize for not having the fancy green screen like the others.
Greg, I gotta say, you kind of look like the Unabomber. I don't mean it in a bad way.
You need a hat too, Greg.
Yeah, you gotta have a
I need
hat.
a hat.
Yeah, you got the scruffy thing, dude.
So you don't feel bad, I'll take mine off.
Yeah, I should take that. He's going to make us, yeah. What have you guys been up to this week?
Yeah. What do I? Oh, I had the day with the grand boys yesterday. Man, that was lucky I could even get up today. 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and a 1-year-old chasing them around for the day. Boy, that was a good time. And other than that, I'm just working on some stuff.
How about you, Greg?
I've actually been dealing with some heavy algorithmic stuff, but that's free time. Day job type stuff has just been rather normal and trying to figure out how the hell to get out of this place.
We talked about before we came on the air, you're also working on eventually setting up sort of a home studio thing, right?
Correct. I've been going through looking at all the green screens and things like that that you know much more about than me.
James is the guy. James is the guy to ask.
Well, I asked you first and you got me started, so.
My problem is I like it too much. So I will sit down and I'll spend an entire day just tweaking on graphics and such, and I really need to do more coding.
Yeah, I'm kind of partially ghosting here. You know, it's like if you look.
Yeah, you are.
Disappearing a little bit. You got me a little bit pale out there too. I'm a pale face today at the Nerd Roundup.
Oh, sorry to hear that. I know how to fix it. Actually, it would only be about a half hour.
So
gonna skip it for now. Yeah, I have been babysitting ferrets this week. My daughter and her husband are going on vacation, and she has two little ferrets, and they're little smelly little weasels. But they don't wear you out as much as grandchildren, so we've been kind of lucky.
You can just throw them in their cage. I did throw one of them in his cage for about 3 hour for a 3 hour nap. It was great.
They're little hellion. You threw wait a minute. You threw one of your grandchildren in his cage for 3 hours.
Well, you know, a baby's bed is kind of like we call it the cage.
Dang,
what can you do? They can't get out. It's a cage.
My oldest son had to have surgery when he was about 6 months old, and they actually put him in a cage. It was sad.
Yeah. Well, at about 18 months, there's the fun time where they learn how to get out of the cage.
Yeah. It's great when the older sibling teaches the younger one, you know, which normally you get another 3 months, but the older sibling goes and shows them how to get out. It's like, oh, thanks.
I used to, my son would get out and crawl down the steps, and I would hide behind the door. And so I'd hear him climbing out, and he'd come walking out in the hall, and I would, from afar, go, "You better get back in your bed, kid." Yeah, I'm not paying for the therapy. Just not going to happen.
What's always the most fun one is the first time they get out.
Boom.
You thought it was solid.
My wife studied child development instruction in college, and she was an expert on how kids grow up and develop. And with our third son, we're bouncing him on the bed. I said, "We need to be careful. He might get off the mat." She's like, no, it's another 3 or 4 months before we can do that. So we walk into the room, bam, he falls off the bed. Oh, she was so sad. He was fine. He did that little thing with his head every now and then. But other than that, he was okay.
But it says in the book that the kids don't fall off the bed until...
Yes. It turns out things don't work as the book says all the time.
Go figure.
So one of the things I did this week was I was kind of sad. I went back to some of the old Nerd Roundups, and some of the links had been deleted, and the content had been changed. And that kind of bummed me out, so I decided to keep a snapshot of the articles we're talking about. That way, if you come back in the future, you'll be able to see kind of the content we're actually commenting on. And to do that, I use a plugin called Single File, and then I'm going to throw it all up on my S3 bucket, and it'll be available off the link. And I'm going to use a nofollow. I'm going to put a big disclaimer on it. There's going to be no ads. It's for reference purpose only.
All right.
So the first topic is, wow, we got to do this. This isn't fun, but we got to do it. The fall of Afghanistan has happened. It's been all over the tech news and the regular news. How have you guys been following along? Evening news, Twitter?
Yeah, radio.
Radio.
Pretty much.
Yeah, it's just...
totally makes me sick.
I think I've cried 2 times when it comes to national policy, and one of those was 9/11, and the other one was this. And it's because all the blood and treasure we put over there. I don't want to get for Clint, but I was in the airport about 10 years ago, and there was a young Marine just got out of boot camp sitting there, and I sat down beside him. I said, I was in the Marines, and I kept wondering, who were these assholes that kept voting to send me overseas to places people wanted to kill me? And I said, I'm that guy now. I take ownership. It's me. And it was. And so it was a very sad thing to see this happen.
So I've got a little bit of a funny personal story around 9/11.
Okay.
So when 9/11 happened, I was living in New Orleans. And I was working out at Stennis Space Center. So what do you think happened when I drove out to work and arrived at the security desk?
Oh, my God.
Coming into Stennis Space Center.
I bet you get met with some armed people, huh?
Not one or two.
Oh, wow. Hmm.
I was out there as a researcher. So
don't shoot me. I flew up to Canada the Monday before for working a new gig, first time on the gig. And on the way up, I asked the pilot, I said, look, I'm an instrument pilot. Can I see what you guys are flying? He said, oh, yeah, come on up. He took me in the cockpit, showed me all the gear. And then on the way back, they looked at me as if, I was the next terrorist. It was a completely different experience.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. We had probably 15 people at the Object Mentor office for 9/11. And I had heard the news on my drive in. Everybody was there busily working. And then it's like everybody was like kind of dumbfounded by the whole thing. And we got back to work because it's like it's too much. We're into it for a while. And it's like, well, we better do something to get our minds off of it. And these people, they came from all over the country and they were stranded in Chicago. At the end of the week, people started renting cars and driving back to California and wherever they came from. I think that was about as far away as somebody was. But
I came into the airport in Winnipeg. It was 2 weeks later coming home, and everybody had little U.S. flag labels on their pins on. It was pretty cool. Okay, so let's just lighten up a little bit. Enough for the fun part.
9/11 was nothing compared to what happened in New Orleans.
Oh,
Katrina.
Katrina, yes. Oh. Yes, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
That was a horrible thing that, wow, just amazing. It's amazing they built so much stuff that they knew was vulnerable to flooding.
Below sea level.
Yeah. And it's still sinking, as I understand. It's just the problem's getting worse, I think.
Yes and no. It depends where you go in the city. So there are some parts of the city that are actually above sea level, and they will not flood.
Yeah.
French Quarter and the Marigny are two good examples of this.
Ah, cool.
The French Quarter often benefits from a good flushing, though.
Correct.
How long were you in New Orleans?
Oh, many years.
Oh, wow. Cool. I never went. I always wanted to go.
You should do.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a three-night town.
Three-night town. Is that like the first night have a bunch of fun, then two more nights trying to recover from the first night? Or?
You could. Well, it kind of depends. I suppose it might only be a two-night town right now.
Well, I'm sorry. I used to work for the New Orleans Police Department. I'm pretty sure if he goes on a Friday, it'll be a three-night town.
Can you guys tell me what you're talking about here? I have no idea what this is.
Well, it's because it's a city of decadence, right? I mean, I don't know. It seemed like they were proud of their decadence. And, you know, you come here, you're going to eat, you're going to drink, you're going to do everything to excess. And, you know, if you live here, you can figure out how to do that, you know, in moderation. But if you're a visitor, you better leave after 3 days. At least this is my own personal assessment of it.
Well, and if you get arrested on a Friday, the court doesn't open until Monday morning. So it's probably going to be a three-night visit.
So that's why you'll be there for 3 days.
So this next article's the 5 levels of autonomous driving. And I keep running across this in conversations with other nerds online. I'm like, okay, somebody said, oh, this car is only level 2. It's not a level 3. And turns out there is a standard level of how intelligent a car is as far as auto driving. And I decided I would keep this and throw it into the podcast because it's just pretty cool stuff. Most of the Teslas are level 2. If you've got like a cruise control, it's level 1. Most of the Teslas are level 2 now. And Audi, the new Audi, has a level 3, the only one. And because of restrictions, they can't bring it into the States yet. But they do. There is a level 3 that they make.
I've got some colleagues that work in, what is it called, expert witness. And I won't mention any names or anything or any cases, but I was talking to him about autonomous cars, self-driving cars, and I said, you know, what's going to happen there? He goes, well, there'll be none until they figure out who you can sue when there's an accident. Now, this was like 5 years ago, but I'm suspecting that the legal aspect is still alive and well. Like you just mentioned, level 3, Audi can't get it approved here yet, right?
Right. And see, that plugs into the legal thing because level 2 is partial autonomous driving. That's where Teslas are. That means you have to keep your hand near the wheel. You're watching it at all times. Level 3, it's conditional automation. Like it would pass a slower car on the interstate on its own. It starts making its own decisions. There's only one that does that, and we can't buy it here. So a lot of people are treating their Tesla with a level 2 as if it were like a level 5 or something, like sleeping in the back seat and all this stuff. So this standard
on the wheel or something. Yeah.
The standard.
It is adaptive cruise control is kind of annoying if you're doing a long trip because all of a sudden, you know, you're trying to go 80 miles an hour through, you know, Georgia. Okay, which is only 10 miles over the limit, so it's not too bad.
Yeah,
I mean,
fine.
I wouldn't.
Yeah,
do that,
10 miles is fine, yeah.
But, you know, and then somebody goes in front of you only doing 72, and it takes you a half hour to figure it out. It's like, oh, shoot, I could have been going 80 this whole half hour if I would have just passed them. So I want that pass the slow guys feature, definitely.
I always, when I'm in a strange channel, always when I'm driving out of this, whatever the city is, I'm always trying to figure out, like, how far do they get away from actually driving this? In some cities, it's like 15, 20 miles an hour. Just go for it. Some cities are not so much.
Yeah. What's interesting with autonomous driving is that everyone focuses on the Teslas and having your car that will drive you from your office 15 minutes back to your home. But that is not where the real market is. The real market is in, I have an 18-wheeler that I need to get from New York to Los Angeles. And automating away all of the truck drivers.
Yes. You know, there is a level 5. The Google company Waymo has a demonstration product somewhere in Arizona, I think. But it can only go from one point to another. There's no steering wheel. It's completely on its own. And that's, I think, what they want to do from warehouse to warehouse. Just put it in the back of the truck, let it go.
Yeah, I suppose that interstate driving might be not as hard of a problem to solve as city driving. They sound both really complicated, but I wonder if that helps at all by having some simplification. But when you get close to your destination, you might need city driving.
Well, let me just throw out a quick statistic here. So in the U.S., there are 3.5 million truck drivers.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of people.
Yes, it's a lot of people. And there are going to be social implications to that as well.
Yeah. And the thing is, I guess for a while, you know, maybe a period of months, they're going to want those truck drivers to just sort of sit there and watch the thing drive.
Months or maybe years?
Yeah, maybe they'll lobby to have it be years.
My guess is they're going to make it years just because that would be such a large economic change.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. You're talking about almost 1% of the population.
Well, you know, the thing you're also going to do is you're going to eliminate drunk driving, which is really cool. I mean, there's some good there's some benefits there too, right?
Yeah.
It's going to be massive change, no doubt about it.
So, given the state of software development,
Would you trust a car or something? our industry code.
Yeah, we want a computer to drive us around. So, the best argument for that I've heard is, yeah, but human drivers are so much worse. It's like, oh, okay.
Well, they need to do the car. Like,
computers might have a place.
Yeah. Have you seen the Boston Dynamics videos? What they did with their robots was they started kicking them and trying to knock them around and stuff, and they sort of worked from a negative space, like make a robot that can't fall over. And they did that, then make a robot that can't fall over where it walks over uneven ground. And that seems like the way to go with cars. Just make it not crash.
Yeah. There you go. This picture of not that guy. go under level one.
Okay.
Of the, there's a picture of a dashboard of a car. Yeah. So this, I think this picture comes from a company called Zooks. If you go to their website, you can see like a live video of their car driving and identifying all the different targets. And so, you know, the ones that might move are in blue. And then the ones that, you know, if you hit them, you're going to definitely kill somebody, you know, are in red. So it's kind of a cool thing. I'd been out to visit them a couple of years ago.
I'm not quite sure you used the right term there in targets.
Well,
so is the points on the dash there? How many points you get for each one of
those?
Well,
I mean, there's targets to miss. Yeah, okay, thanks.
Yeah, they're doing that. They've got the LiDAR they're using to actually scan their environment. And as I understand it, they've got multiple computers, some doing object detection, some sort of figuring out trends. It's a bunch of really cool stuff.
A lot of computing involved.
A lot of computing happening in real time.
Yep. And then I'm not going to say what company this is, but my son works for a company that basically one of the projects he was on was cars communicating with each other in real time so that like that bike that's right there if somebody on the right was passing on the right, they might get a notification saying, oh, by the way, there's somebody crossing the crosswalk. You might want to do something about that, right? Rather than zoom across on the right. Right? You know, so it's like this, the cars are starting to, you know, telemetry up.
That's
and
wild.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
I saw this tweet the other day, and I can't source it whether it's true or not, but they were talking about Teslas, and they said if you hold the shift key down and click a certain way on your dash, it charges $18,000 to your credit card automatically. Like, doesn't ask a confirmation. There's no code. It just boom. It's you're installing some new features, and they assume that you're paying for them.
Oh, so that's an Elon Musk Easter egg.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, and I'm gonna throw this just a slightly different way. So now that we have cars that are driving around cameras, and let's imagine that we get 100 times as many of them. What happens with surveillance of that camera data?
Yeah.
Well, it's like
it gets collected.
Like these things listening in on everything.
Right, but this is.
Think about when we have 100 times as many of them. We've got
a
story, actually, I think three or four down about there's a Catholic story about going and using publicly available data to out a priest as being gay. And it's like, there's a lot of issues with that. It's just, So first we got to talk about I know what you guys are waiting for. It's the, what the hell is this thing? The Trans Topological Axon Insulator.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. When I heard about this, I couldn't sleep for weeks. It was just a... So there is a thing called a topological axion insulator, and it's a quantum thing. And as I understand it, just think tiny super magnets that are tunable. And researchers have actually made this. It's not in production yet, but they figured out how to make them. And then next up will be actually trying to put them in chips, and it's going to make everything better, faster, stronger, smelling better. So I read the article. I'm like, hey, this is awesome. What the hell is it? So I found another article. So this guy actually explains what it is and what it can do. And it's still a little on the fuzzy side, but yeah, good enough, I guess. The holy grail of solid state physics. Where have you heard this before? We get a holy grail every week. There's a holy grail of something every week. We're going to run out of grails.
Yeah, interesting. So what's going to be the first application?
I think you're going to put chips, optical chips, better hard drives for the people who are still using hard drives. I think the RAM guys are going to change. It's going to change a bunch of stuff.
Well, there's some battery speculation going on here, too.
Yes. So. Yeah, because when you get, like, the reason they call it a holy grail is when you get down that low and you discover something new, it's a whole thing that opens up then.
Yeah, creative people can go to town with that.
Yes. It's a new building block. So this next one Greg might like, this is SoundStream. They plugged in a neural network to audio compression, and they're getting really, really great compression ratios. I thought this was cool, really more from a standpoint of watching the discussion on Hacker News, because there's a lot of audio nerds, I guess, are computer nerds too. And it's just a bunch of cool stuff about what would you do with a better compression system? Do people even know how much their audio is compressed or not?
What's always made me kind of interested in audio compression is that we already know how to do much, much, much better audio compression. The thing is, nobody wants to use it. So if I take the majority of songs that you listen to, there are repetitive sounds that are recorded. What if instead of actually having every recording of every sound, I were to distribute? Well, this is a kick drum. The kick drum is going to be happening on threes and eights. It's
the PK zip of audio compression. Cool stuff.
If I were to distribute in that way, we could get down to a couple hundred bytes. But
I think that
I'm also giving you the song.
Yes.
I think early, I'm not sure what the state of the art with CDMA telephony is these days, but back in the beginning of it, what Qualcomm was doing, I think some of their early patents were that they were basically sending these codes, which were about the sounds that were coming out, and then they're recreating human voice. From those codes, right? Rather than, time division multiplexing is a different thing, and so CDMA. I don't know. It would have been maybe a layman's understanding at the time, but it was, might have been had some of that compression technology in there too.
To Greg's point, as I understand this neural codec, it's just that. So as you train the system over a series of musical files, it finds repeating sounds on its own. That it can then represent in the network. It learns how to make a kick drum. Hmm. And then it just replaces in what it knows already. So cool stuff.
But all it's really doing is reverse engineering information that we already had to start with.
Well, the thing is...
Yeah, making it smaller.
Well, the sound itself is a three-dimensional wave. So by the time you've captured it, you've already sort of simplified the whole problem.
Okay, so... I apologize because this is something that's near and dear to my heart. I used to produce music.
Cool.
We already have a solution to the music compression problem. I could just send you MIDI files.
Yeah, you were describing MIDI earlier. I didn't want to go into it. Yeah, that's pretty much what you're doing. And MIDI's actually a lot better than people think it is.
And a lot worse and more complicated than people think it is. Try setting up some physical hardware over MIDI.
Yeah, I've been there. Yeah, been there. No fun. So Opus, I learned that there's a thing called an Opus, is a codec that's, I think, open source. That's, this guy says, the best codec ever. Don't know. I'll probably look into it at some point if I want to switch all my music over.
And by the way, just since we were talking about MIDI.
Oh, cool.
You just happen to have one.
I happen to have one within 3 feet of me.
Yeah, I've got the Stage 3, but I can't pick that up and carry it around. It's a little too big. I got a Stage keyboard, and I had two key. I had a dual-tier deal going on for a while. It's fun stuff.
I forget if it was Netflix or what, but I just recently watched The Making of The Dark Side of the Moon.
Ooh.
And that was pretty cool because they're doing it all with this ancient technology. And, so if you want to waste an hour on something cool that, brings back some music memories, I'd recommend that one.
I am definitely going to try that, James, because that was a favorite album back in the day.
And then the producer of that was Alan Parsons.
You're kidding.
The engineer. Oh, and he's like playing this thing, with all these gauges and stuff to bring in the different sounds. It was really cool to see him explain the whole process. He said, today you do it with a computer.
It amazes me. I took 12 years of classical piano when I was growing up. And so I can sit down and play. I can read music and play it. I can compose my own stuff, just having fun. I know enough to play at the keyboard now. I don't play the keyboard. But what amazes me is that is just a tiny piece of all the stuff you're talking about. So, I sit down with my synth, and I know how to play the keyboard, and I start playing with the knobs, and it's like 3 hours later, I finally got something that sounds kind of weird, and it's not playing the piano anymore. It's doing this other thing.
Yeah.
It's a total art form.
Just as you guys brought up The Dark Side of the Moon, and there's probably some people who are going to be listening to this that might be around there. I believe there's two or three of them. One of them is in Houston that I know off the top of my head, where you have planetariums actually run Dark Side of the Moon planetarium shows. Huh. They are very, very cool.
I think the one in Arizona, what's that one? Yeah, we went and saw that planetarium. It was cool stuff, really cool stuff.
What I'm unsure of, though, is if all of them are doing the same show that was made by like one planetarium guy that then sent it around to everybody, or whether they're all different ones just onto Dark Side of the Moon.
I don't spoil the fun for me. I don't want to know. Yeah, I love planetariums. My son bought a telescope when he was growing up. I like looking at stuff. It's just astronomy to me is a thing that you start off, it looks kind of easy, then suddenly you're out in the middle of the night trying to figure out where some nebula is somewhere. It just gets kind of tough.
I'm not sure if I told you this, but I've actually been in the market buying a telescope.
Recently?
Yes.
I'll be there.
And you're going to get a complete laugh out of this. So the person I've been talking to is actually my cousin, who is an astrophysicist.
Whoa.
And happens to be very into astronomy.
Oh, boy.
So very quickly, he might be. I went from buying maybe a $100 to $200 telescope to now I'm looking at things that are built in 17 pieces that I spread around a 100-meter radius.
What are your neighbors going to say?
What? You building a radio telescope? What do you got going on?
Essentially, like we started getting into things like radio telescopes, and it's like, you could build one of those too, right?
Oh, my God.
It's like, well, this is not quite what I had in mind. I just wanted to have a telescope I could bring outside and maybe I can see Venus one day.
Huh. In my son's scope, I think it was $300-$400. It's a big reflector, like 15 inches. Of course, reflectors, you can get bigger ones. And you see Saturn, you see the craters of the moon, you see Jupiter. It's enough to get people interested in the topic.
Yeah. And a polar alignment is kind of nice. So you can easily track an object or...
What I have found with astronomy, though, is that it's very much like many of the things that we deal with in computer science. So you basically have an exponential cost curve.
There's no end to what you could spend.
Yes. Okay.
Well, and it's very quickly you go from, I want to be able to see the craters on the moon, to I need to buy a $3,000 28-inch reflector.
Yeah. And I need an EMON, like a observatory to put the reflector in. So you can buy backyard observatories.
Well, in order to be able to use it, I need to drive 2.5 hours from my house. And
you need a bigger vehicle to hold your 28-inch telescope.
My cousin's got into this same astrophotography stuff. He's just an amateur, but he got into doing pictures of nebula and the moon and everything. And he's posted stuff on social media. It is just really, really cool. I really envy him. But it's quite a skill. You take a lot of shots. You have to stack them a certain way. There's software for that. It's not just looking through the scope. So the next article is, Yale researchers say that social media's outrage machine has the biggest influence on moderate groups. Also, water wet, and the air is outside. The interesting thing about this was the fact that moderates are most influenced by the outrageous stuff. I guess if you're really into things, or hey, John Kern.
Hello, hello. Sorry, I'm late.
Mr. Kern, no problem. I need to rejigger the thing here. Hang on a second. You guys will need to tell a joke or something while I'm doing this.
John, are you getting anywhere today?
Not very far.
Yeah.
Just had some good meetings talking about feature flippers and how to help a team reduce late stage integration breaking crap. So.
Feature switch stuff, I guess, right?
Yeah. Feature toggles. Although they might be doing it wrong, it's hard to know.
If your tests pass, you ship. And if you don't ship when your tests pass, your tests are bad.
Yeah, that's the problem. They didn't have tests. They were blaming the method. And I was like, no, you did the right thing. The method wasn't wrong. The philosophy wasn't wrong. It's the other team. They were the uphill skiers that just smashed into the downhill skier.
And, uphill skiers.
I asked her, I said, are you a skier? Because I don't know if this analogy will work, but yeah.
You run all kinds of weird problems. I had one of the first teams I coached, they couldn't get anything done. And I started asking them, like, well, we reached this one point and we have to meet in a committee somewhere and they have to approve this thing. And it takes 2 weeks. And it was this, I'm like, why do you wait 2 weeks? And it destroyed their velocity, destroyed everything. So what we did is they always approved of whatever the thing was. We finally got them to do an email. They approved by email. Then it just got to be an automated process.
Yeah, well, sometimes.
The main question that you should be asking there is, if you've approved everything that's come through, why do you have an approval process?
See, this you must be new to this entire technology thing, Greg. You're just not getting the hang of this at all, okay?
You must be from some other planet.
I used to do a lot of work with Motorola back when they were a big company. And one of the groups I worked with, I remember going to the design review meeting because they made a big deal about their reviews. And one of these guys said, yeah, I heard you talking in the hall. You know, I heard you talking in the hall a few weeks ago about your misconception with this technical thing. And I knew the design review meeting was coming up, so I would tell you here, because I guess you get extra brownie points for bringing stuff up in a design review meeting.
In front of everybody, so, you get to say, yeah.
So this guy who he overheard with the wrong idea 2 weeks earlier, you know, worked for 2 weeks with the wrong idea. And
the guy knew all along. You could have told him.
Yeah, could have told him.
Team players. Ooh. Yep.
That's right, yep. We wonder why they're only a shell of their former self.
Yeah, it's weird that organizations very quickly get into don't rock the boat and look good in front of the boss. And once you adopt those two things, it's just you're downhill. It's no good after that.
Oh, so bringing things back to cool technology stuff.
Okay.
I have something sitting here in front of me.
Okay. Looks like, is that a daughter board or motherboard?
Looks like you can put a bunch of cards in it.
Yeah.
Yep.
Ah, you are correct, sir. You can put a bunch of cards.
Are those ESA cards?
Yeah, they're not. It looks like almost like
graphics.
Memory.
It fits a Raspberry Pi into each of them.
Oh my God, that sounds cool. Oh yeah.
You can make a supercomputer with Raspberry Pis. Great.
Everybody's doing. So that's the thing now, James.
That would be on this board 7 Raspberry Pis that are clustered.
I'm drooling. This is really cool. Yeah. Then you go Kubernetes on all of it. Yeah.
Well, and then you have shared USB ports. You have shared Ethernet. You have shared.
The beauty of that, James, is you get some cloud experience without having to pay Amazon like $200 an hour for 10 servers.
But it literally, you can actually bring stuff up on it to treat it like a private cloud server.
Yes. And there are actually some businesses, I think Subway maybe, the sandwich shop, that are using clusters of Pis as their store machines.
Really? Wow. It's cool.
But my main goal for it, though, was the ability for me to be able to run a 7-node event store cluster that I have in my backpack.
You know, I had to do the same thing when I learned SharePoint. You had to go into, you had to download VMware and set up 3 or 4 different VMware machines, and one talked to the other, and it was not fun.
Well, what's been funny for me about the technology associated, so if I were to go back 10, 15 years ago, when we were to want to do a demo of Event Store, we'd have to bring 3 1U boxes. Today, I can fit it in my backpack.
And what you have is actually much more representative of what would happen in, like, when they really deploy something.
Probably not.
Really?
Well, because you're probably not going to run everything on one board.
Well, yeah, you had to pretend that part. It's some pretend parts there.
When I used to bring physical nodes, that's more likely what you're going to be running.
But yeah, okay, so that's you're using the same kind of message bus as you'd use in a real system, right?
Right.
And then the sort of the setup, I guess you're doing firewalls in each of the Pis that you're going to have the ports opened up for the message service to run back and forth.
You can do, yes.
And then it gets even more complicated. You start talking about shared storage. Are you going to have, and I imagine this thing would have a shared drive.
No. You would not have shared storage. Each of the Raspberry Pis is going to have their own storage.
Yeah. You can do that. You can do that both ways at the same time, because the Pi's got a little spot you can put in the little drive. That's the way I've got my Pi set up. But then I think the board should have some sort of shared memory system. I'm not sure.
Well, but when we're trying to show Event Store, what we'd be doing is deliberately only using the Pi storage. Because you want to see the replication happening, right?
You do. So and I'm going to just wade right in here because this is fun. When you're passing an event, can it reference things, I guess we would say, on the heap? Can it reference things off somewhere offline storage or whatever that's maybe not part of the message itself, but that would be where you would have that, right?
I mean, you could by putting an ID inside of your event, but as far as we're concerned, that ID is part of your message.
Correct. I don't want to be sending messages with my pictures of my cat in the message. I want just the message to go through with my cat picture somewhere else, right?
Obviously, you can send that to us, but we have no understanding of that. That is only for you.
See, this is interesting, and this gets to the S part of CQRS, I imagine, right? Because if you put it outside the message store, it is no longer part of the subject domain. It, by definition, is somewhere floating around somewhere.
Correct. But for event store, we look at your event as being a vector of bytes.
Right. But you have to pass. This is the old functional, we pass the state around thing. The message is going to have everything the message needs. Or you're not going to be able to do that left fold from beginning on to current to actually get the current state.
That is correct, but from an event store perspective, it's a vector of bytes.
Right. Yes. It is. It's a blob.
From our perspective, it's just a vector of bytes.
Yeah, and if you use bit packing and can figure out that these bits mean this word and this Yeah, I remember doing that with the missile transponder back in the 80s. It's a vector. It's a vector message device.
It frees up the coder actually to do the vector any way they want to. It would be different ways for different applications.
Yeah, we actually had to have Air Force and a Navy version of the dictionary that packed that vector with different, you know, kind of like a different map of data.
And I'm sorry, I think it needs to be said here, but what's your vector, Victor?
Roger. So
another crazy, I was just gonna say another crazy thing. Speaking along these lines, is we did this reconfigurable simulator with a bunch of normal compute, you know, PCs back in the day. Back this would have been late 80s, early 90s, and you know, ribbon basically a card on every computer. So one computer would be the aerodynamic model, one computer would be the outside visual display, one computer would be the control system, and but the little ribbon cable that connected them all, basically that was a shared chunk of essentially state data about the core, you know, essentially the aircraft's core information.
Work with that's kind of a double E thing, right? More of a
yeah, it was pretty cool. It was some folks in the company did the board designs and created that, you know, so that we could essentially dump the, you know, the aerodynamic model would update of memory, the outside world thing that had a display. Am I pitched up? Am I rolling? You know, it would use the right information out of that. You know, so it was basically instantaneous sharing.
The instantaneous thing takes you into a much more complex domain. After the .com crash, I was working with a software-defined radio bunch, and they were doing kind of real-time ribbon cable type stuff on a board. And I was helping the engineers. We were modeling what the system did, and we got down to the point where it's like, no, this is all instantaneous. This is signaling back and forth. There's no messaging. Mm-hmm. It's just there or not.
Mm-hmm. I am rather certain that John and I have likely run into each other in the past at some point, because I work with cameras on those planes. And our big problem was the planes, they fly like this as they're taking photos. So now we've got 10,000 photos from this plane that's been flying over. And we want to find the best pixels out of all of those photos.
Yeah, so did you do like a geometric kind of, I guess, the plane tilting kind of thing? Or?
No. I can tell you, given a pitch and roll.
Oh, okay. Oh, so you had the data. You had the roll, pitch and roll data coming in at the same time as the picture.
So now I have the photo. I can tell you what the size of the pixel actually is.
Yeah.
But now we have 10,000 photos.
Yeah.
And what we want is to geolocate every pixel and to find the best pixels throughout those 10,000 photos to make one big photo.
That sounds like fun.
Fun stuff. A lot of math. a lot of projections on the different planes. That's all I remember. It's just tons of transformations.
I won't go into 3D gaming.
That was actually not the hard part. It is literally not at all the hard part.
And the hard part was?
That was math. I can deal with math. The hard part was, is there a cloud in the pixel?
What you mean outside the plane or inside? we've got multiple clouds here, okay?
Now we have the plane at this angle. Is there a cloud in this photo? And is there possibly a solar reflection in this photo?
This
is where it starts getting hot.
A new realm of digital signal processing. Yeah, we did a lot of image processing as well. Back in the day. Crazy.
So next article is a social tech article. This is interesting to me because I don't mind talking about politics or religion here. The interesting thing to me here is the church, the Catholic Church, over the centuries has had a whole bunch of religious wars about what to believe and who the conservatives and liberals were and all this stuff. And that's outside, I don't know know anything about that at all, but that's kind of bled over into the social media aspect where a bunch of more conservative Catholics have went out and done some data mining and outed one of the bishops as being gay. And so the question is, well, are we just going to go back and fight all these religious wars? I mean, they really had religious wars. Are they going to go back and do that, fight that online? And if so, what's the rules? What's fair or not? I don't know. It's just interesting these people are having this problem because they've been struggling with it for centuries. Good article. A lot of text.
Is that one of the conclusions of the article? Is that it's infighting in the church?
Yeah, it is. The reporter's a Catholic himself, and he's very conflicted about how this plays out. I think he's probably one of the more liberal Catholics. But you know, his question is, what should be the ground rules going forward as far as how do we struggle for power in the church without sort of violating our own, you know, ways of believing?
Well, let me just throw out a kind of weird alternative theory. What would happen if we had a group of people who were outing Al-Qaeda members for being gay?
Okay, I guess it sounds like a new dating app.
It would be utterly hilarious.
I guess so. I don't know. Gay terrorists really don't make me laugh too much. I don't know. Maybe if they could juggle or something. I don't know. Yeah, it is.
I think it's about outing somebody, right? You know,
it is about taking pride of information that would embarrass somebody, whatever that would be. This is outing in this case, but yes. Maybe the guy would be a closet heroin user. Same kind of, something that would be very embarrassing in their social group.
Yeah.
There's no way that we currently have preventing these things from happening.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. Somebody said, you know, you can pretend like your life is your own, but really not anymore. That's just that world never does not exist anymore.
Well, this is a free choice. It's not a sign. We're not dictated to have to carry tracking.
We're not, but we were just talking about auto drive cars, and the cars are going to be taking videos everywhere they go as they auto drive. So you might not need to carry your phone around, but every car you pass 20 years from now will be shooting, being a picture of you walking around.
But what is it storing it?
We don't know. That's the question.
It certainly could, right?
Yeah. Why would you? Yeah. There are funny, like I forget how to Google it, but you can Google funny Google camera things, like, you know, people on the street or, you know, there's some pretty funny things that those Google cars capture. They tend to, matter of fact, there was, I think my father-in-law saw that as we were heading towards their house, saw me and our family in a car driving to their house, like on a street view, when he was looking for like a plumber. You know, it's kind of funny.
Well, this is what happened in that story. Was there was a data set, I forget exactly which data set it was, but it wasn't well known that these people were able to go into and search to find this information out that wasn't available before. So that's
I'm surprised this was commercially available data. Like, what?
That is kind of wild, isn't it?
That sounds illegal.
It should be. It certainly should be.
Yeah, that would be like, why can't that be your healthcare records?
Well, see,
it just means that the government would be the only one to do the...
Yeah, that giant NSA building that they're
in Utah.
That they have.
Yeah, I love you guys.
Yeah.
Just in case you're.
Yeah.
So this next story, guys, I am a mixed mind about this. I gotta cue it up. This is a tweet from a guy who used to work on Internet Explorer 3.0, and it caused this tremendous firestorm on Twitter, and it's basically, sadly, there were divorces and broken families and bad things that came out of that. But I also learned that even a 20,000-person company, you can get a team of 100 people to work like their lives depended on it. And, you know, it's like I understand what he's saying. It's good to have a job that you're passionate about, and people don't want to come to work just do a death march. But I don't think you can say something that nuanced on Twitter without people just trashing you.
Your previous article.
Yeah, this is not so. This is like an example of somebody not, I used to say, not being able to read the room, not understanding the medium's not the appropriate medium for the message. It's just like, you know, there were a bunch of people that were killed and horribly tortured, but we got free sandwiches. It's like, nah, you can't begin with that and end the other way. It's just too much.
A little bit like, yeah, they're chanting death to America, but they seem friendly.
They're friendly folks.
Okay. Nice.
Next is what domain to use for your home network. If you guys set up your home LAN, did you know there's an official name to use for your home LAN?
No.
No.
Home.arpa.
ARPA?
Yep.
I did not know that.
I did not. According to RFC 8375.
So then does this Linux box over here have a subdomain that I don't know about?
No, it's up to you to set it up. So if you're running a DHCP server anywhere, you should be using home.arpa.
So my main problem is, this is not a problem many people have, but when I go back to Florida, I pull out my SSD card and my video graphics card. Those are small and fit in my suitcase. The rest of the stuff has to stay where it is. It gets plugged into the other computer. And now I got to reteach my computers where, like my MacBook Pro needs to know where that one is. And things change. And so I have to go in and find the right config files and change them. What else can I do?
Buy a Raspberry Pi. Set up a Pi hole in it. Set up the DHCP server and then plug it in when you plug the other stuff in, and it will tell all the things on the network how to talk to one another. And the config will stay the same. Just take it with you.
Okay, I got to bring one more piece of gadgetry with. Okay.
Oh, they're like it's like that big. It's a tiny thing.
I know. Yeah, I've got four of them back in my workroom back there.
First world problem.
Yeah, definitely a first world problem.
The tiny computer's too big.
But does he really need a Raspberry Pi, or can he get away with a BeagleBoard?
Yeah.
Well, can't they just change a config file so that these things know the name?
Well, it depends on how they're subnetting your NAT. You want to know the answer to that. How's your NAT being subnetted?
Okay. I don't know how to ask these questions. So.
Well, stop editing it. Just create two.
Oh, another good idea. Bash script.
But there's a name. Oh, yeah, but I have to switch them. Right.
Oh, so
I guess it could detect what network it's on, look at the IP address, and then adjust. But I don't know.
So this was interesting to me exactly for what we're doing now, which is once you start talking about home networks, the nerds come out of the woodwork, and it's all like, well, you know, I would never use home.arpa. I always use home.lan, and the subnetting thing, the DHCP servers. This is like asking people if their baby's ugly.
Well, I'm a bit weird on this because I lived for a couple of years in a large apartment complex. I actually VPN everything over the network.
I do that when I'm on my laptop in a place. I should probably just have it on all the time, huh?
Well, if you have it on all the time, it seems to make Google always ask questions like, "Prove to say you are who you are." Doesn't that happen to you?
What I did when I set this home studio up is I set it up so that I could pack it all up technically, and I used wired internet. I turn off the Wi-Fi on everything. And so I've got my Raspberry Pi, I've got my computer, I've got my cameras. It all runs off of RJ45 wiring. And then I don't use the thing they gave me, the modem that's coming in from the ISP provider. Mine's all wired too.
John, I actually got a lot less of things from Google and other companies of, are you really sure you are who you are? Remember, I travel extensively. So instead of me showing up on a new hotel Wi-Fi every 3 days, I am now showing up on the same IP address every time.
So you VPN to what, a Google box?
It's actually AWS, but close enough.
So you're running out some space there, I guess, on an EC2 type thing.
So a problem I probably won't have again in the future is like doing business in China. And when you're in China, if you want to use something like Twitter, you've got to go with a VPN. And while you're doing that, every couple hours, the the Great Firewall of China detects that you're sneaking through it, and they cut off that path. And then you got to reconfigure your VPN, and then it'll work for a couple hours. And then, you know, I'm just, now it's like, I better not, well, I'm not going to go there. I don't think I'll go there again, but I probably wouldn't play any of these games because I don't want to be arrested.
So, James, before you leave, this last article, this is, you know, you can list a directory containing 8 million files, but not with LS. So somebody put 8 million files on a directory, tried to list it, it crashed their computer. And this was even more funny because somebody came online and said, no, actually, you can. LS has a non-stream, or non-buffering mode. There's LS-L-P or something. And so you can, actually. You can put 8 million files on your directory if you want to. Yeah, I don't know what you would want to, but if you want to.
Saints be praised.
Yeah.
But does it work with LS-AL?
No, yeah, it does. Yeah, the answer was LS-L-P, I think. Or, and it just, what LS does, as soon as it grabs the information, it just kicks it out to the screen. There's no formatting, there's no columning, there's no color, nothing.
You might be able to end up with 8 million files if you're doing some video stuff where you have a whole bunch of discrete images you're trying to put together.
It's not that crazy of an idea. You know, you can have like some sort of Merkle tree type thing where you're doing some cold storage maybe somewhere.
Yeah, you're taking an image and storing each pixel in one.
No. Oh, you want
and the file name is the coordinates.
To have 8 million files, you would, in almost all circumstances, be a complete fool to do it. So, down when we start talking about file systems and how they allocate files.
I learned a long time ago never to say this is a completely stupid thing to do because there's somebody out there that's doing it right now that's probably got a doctorate in computer science.
It's just not common.
It's not common. Yeah, the most use cases, it doesn't involve it.
I would say you have a problem with organization if 8 million things are in one flat area. But who knows?
Either that or you've got a really good memory. Really good memory.
Yeah, that is funny. Although I'm always jealous of the folks who wrote things like LS and grep. You know, all that stuff is like, that's so... I'm pretty sure it doesn't get a lot of maintenance.
And, you know, like, it works the same now as it did 20 years ago. You can run the same code and it does the same stuff.
Yeah, it was very, you know, it's like an idea, almost like single piece flow is an ideal. This was very single, you know, very crisp, clear. This is what I do for a living.
They collect new switches continually.
What if we could make grep talk to a satellite?
But grep can talk to anything. Grep can talk to anything anyway, right?
Well, first you have to do a find from satellite dash name, right? And then you feed that to grep.
Oh my god, this is scary.
And download 8 million files.
There's some satellite right now with 8 million files in a directory. Somebody's got to help me. So James, it is the time. You want to bail now or?
Oh, well, I'll bail out. In a minute.
Okay. This next one, Michael Feathers tweeted this. This guy did this list of programming languages, whether or not the language itself was portable. And his point being, it's sort of a commentary on whether the languages are modular, because you only run in one spot, you're not very modular. If you run everywhere, you're sort of a plug-and-play type deal. And most languages are sort of tightly coupled into wherever they're being compiled at.
Hmm. I would definitely agree with the first two, C and C++.
There is no programming language that is tied to where it's compiled at.
Say it again.
There is no programming language that is tied to where it is. There's only the question of what the programming language is written in.
Well, what kind of effort, right? Like with C, you can use C about anywhere, right? Because it's got the macros for different platforms, and you can go 8-bit, 64-bit. It's still C.
And I might have been the only one that has dealt with this in the past. So, do you generally know how you build a compiler?
No, I'm an engineer. I love the fact that other people care about shit like that. I just want to use it.
Yeah, I mean, the
general way of building a compiler is that you write it in the language of the compiler.
That's called bootstrapping the compiler. And yet you want to reach that point. You usually start with assembly or C to get to that point.
Guess that's why Ruby doesn't have a compiler.
Probably so. There's some guys that were trying to take C Sharp and make their own operating system out of C Sharp for a while. I don't know how that went. Probably not so well.
But the entire bootstrapping process allows me to say that pretty much any language that you have, the only thing I need to do to move it anywhere else is to write a new bootstrap.
I think what the issue here is, I need to clarify this a little bit. So, yeah, you can write a compiler wherever it is, and you can bootstrap it wherever, and it's going to be the same compiler. However, different places you run the executing code are going to have different library systems you're going to use to things like print out to the screen or, you know, read from the keyboard or whatever. And those either work in a bunch of different places or only one place.
I'm rather sure printf works pretty much everywhere.
I would hope so. I really would hope so. But some of this
Probably with an asterisk next to it, you know, because on a given machine that might have 32-bit integers and then another one that has supports long, and, you know,
printf probably has 27 asterisks next to it.
The compilers, like, now are looking at the format string to see if it's actually compatible with the types that you're going to, you know, sort of static analysis stuff going on. And the C and C++ are getting kind of annoying at all the things that they're so picky about. I suppose it's helping somebody, but.
So I had a client last year that wanted to do something with a static site generator. So if you don't know what a static site generator is, the idea is your website is just a page that people can carry on a USB drive where they want to go. It's simple. It's a static site. But somebody, of course, had to make a generator to make this one-page web thing. Went to install the generator. Oh, my God. I thought I was, like, downloading this next space shuttle code. It was, like, hundreds of Pentium packages, this crap all over the place, just to go, like, hello, world. Here's my cat. It's an incredible amount of linkage there.
Huh. So, James, one thing I've laughed about is, over the course of my career, I've worked in many, many languages. And many of them have changed greatly over the years. And how you use them has changed greatly over the years. One of my favorites to still work in is Vax Pascal. It hasn't changed at all.
I never did Pascal.
Never did Fortran.
It still works.
I think I looked at some once.
The way it used to work. And by the way, has anyone else here ever received the orange books?
No. Now you're talking about the CD specs, right? Wasn't it called the orange book, the CD-ROM specs?
No. The orange books that come with Vax.
I worked on a Vax.
I didn't say Vax with DNS.
When
you buy a copy of VMS, they actually deliver you an entire bookshelf.
I remember this.
And then they fill the entire bookshelf with books.
Yeah, I worked on some PDPs and some Vaxes. That's when I learned Adventure. The Adventure was on a Vax. The Adventure game.
Early Zork.
Mentioned anywhere?
John, I'm probably dating myself here, but
not with us.
You know that the colors of the books changed from year to year.
Oh my God!
See, I was an engineer.
Yeah, back to the engineer thing.
Those books were in the IT department.
Oh, that's right, yeah, operations.
And that guy told me about, hey, you might like this program thing here called Vax. Here you go. And so I should have seen those books. I might have learned more. But, yeah, I don't think I saw those books.
So speaking of things that stay the same, this article here, Imperative Thinking and the Making of Sandwiches, this guy brings up SQL as being a language that stayed kind of the same for many, many years. Use it now just like you used to use it. And there was a lot of SQL hate when this essay was published, and I don't have a problem with SQL. I don't rarely use it, but it seems to work fine when I use it, so it's all good.
SQL is a beautiful functional language.
It's set theory, pretty much. It's just a structured set theory, how one set relates to another, and if you know, it's pretty simple stuff. Maybe left outer join, and you know, some of that stuff can get a little gnarly, but not too much. The trick is with SQL is if your query gets too complex, you break it into smaller pieces to make it a view or a subquery or whatever, and build that first.
Yeah, I guess I tend to try to build logic, deep logic in the objects that are using, you know, and keep the SQL simple. It's the freaking stored procedures that are like 5,000 lines long that have no tests. Those are the scary things.
Woo-hoo. You just fill out these 17 parameters and call them. They work fine.
Yeah. Good luck. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember stumbling upon some of those situations. Oh, yeah, we put all that logic in the stored procedure calls. It's like, what? Okay.
So I'm going to throw out a little bit of a detail here about SQL that most of the listeners will probably not know. The reason that SQL is actually so useful as a language is that it's not Turing complete.
I didn't know it. I never worked. So Turing complete, to bring us up to speed, is the Turing tape where you have the three types of instructions that can represent any sort of computational system. It's not complete because...
So SQL is not Turing complete in terms of its structure, the way that you lay things out. And the main benefit behind it is I can prove things terminate.
All right. Okay, so I think the reason it's not Turing complete is you don't carry state forward in SQL. SQL is just describing as if you were wiring together a bunch of tables with physical wires, whereas a computer program is this, does this, does that, does this. Different.
Well, you're probably using quite the wrong term there. SQL describes set operations.
Right.
Everything inside of SQL is finite.
Correct. Which is
and it's very specifically designed to be this.
Hello, Greg. Wouldn't you're probably using the wrong term. I'm going, do stuff better.
Do stuff better.
More good.
Hey, speaking of doing stuff, I'm going to have to drop off, you guys.
All right, thanks.
Sorry
good
to leave
early.
You.
All right.
Okay. Good to see y'all. Take care.
You too.
There's nothing you said.
But the fact that SQL is not Turing complete is actually a feature of SQL.
Yes, I would agree.
It was one of the main design goals.
So why should anybody care about something being Turing complete or not?
Because it sounds good. It sounds really, really awesome.
No, there's actually a very good reason for it.
Because if
SQL had been Turing complete, then you run into the problem of execute an infinitely running query.
Halting problem. I don't know how many people have had this experience, but you know, I used to go do data modeling and I got into object-oriented programming. And you write a data model that you make into an object model, or class model, and at some point you realize that your transforms can be described in set theory, and you're like, the whole code just kind of goes away, just goes into the database, and you're kind of done. It's an update from here to there based on these conditions, and there's very, very little you need to put into front end. Now, I'm not saying I would code that way today, to John's point, but you realize that by having it done in set relations, it's much better, much easier to maintain than if you've done it imperatively.
Well, I guess...
John, there's a beautiful point of getting rid of the infinite.
Sure. makes the processors happier.
Yeah,
if you can no longer end up in the infinite, then we can start talking about boundaries of everything.
Yeah, you're exactly
right.
And
that was one of the main design goals.
Yes. It's funny how we get back to subject area yet again, but it's an important topic. Okay, guys.
There is actually another version of SQL where it actually runs infinitely.
This is
imagine we had a new keyword in SQL that was called continue.
Right. which gets back to the Turing and then, thing.
And yeah, and it actually, this exists in varying databases, where I can say select star from foo, where x equals bar, continue.
And they do some of that with temp tables, with database guys, but not, the state carried over is a set state, not just a, you know, because if you do a continue, you could just put damn near anything in there. So if you're doing strict set relations, you know you got x here, y there, you're not going to need more than x times y in the resulting table. But you're probably using the wrong term, I guess. This is good stuff. It's tough to talk about set theory relations when you're kind of switching from, you know, Python, Java, over to SQL. They're different animals.
Yeah, for sure.
I don't think the imperative and the old guys think about boundaries very much as sort of maybe the functional and database folks do. And I don't think they think about terms of set relations. I think you're talking about object relations, your collection class, various things like that. That's quite common, but they don't think of those relationships as set relationships.
No.
Greg's making
that's reasonable.
Funny. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay, guys, let me shut this thing down and be right back, okay? Okay. You have wasted yet another hour of your precious time. You could have been studying to be a neurosurgeon or a doctor or perhaps a programmer, listening to us some Nerd Roundup, and we're really glad you came by. We had a hoot today. I'm Daniel Markham, and I will see you on the internet.